Good morning. So many people. No wonder that chant sounded so strong. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. It's a practice for me just to take everybody in a little bit. So I want to start off by saying happy Pride. You know, may we someday live in a world where who we are and who we choose to love is fully celebrated. So today I wanted to talk to you about the kind of practicality of our practice of Zen. I wanted to try to kind of describe how these forms and the way we practice together actually helps us. And you know, what I love about Zen, I really love Zen because it really is, it honors the contemplative wisdom, the wisdom that arises not just through studying texts, but through how we engage with our everyday activities. So I want to honor and say that I'm inspired by reading this huge, rich wealth of Buddhism wisdom in the formal sutras. I mean, it's just endless the amount of text you can read, and then modern interpretations of Buddhism. It's almost like a book on Buddhism is coming out every day. And it's a little much to keep up with. You should see our desk. It's covered. I can't even see our window anymore. So I get a lot of aspiration, a lot of clarity from doing that. However, for me, my understanding and my whatever realizations or insights or capacities I've developed really all have come through this embodied practice of Zen. And the practices of Zen are not just Zazen, though Zazen is the primary vehicle, but all of the kind of forms you see as you walk around this place. So meeting with a teacher, community organizing, how do we get everybody in this space on time, do the talk, leave, right? So all the organizing of this flow of beings, taking on practice roles. So when you walked in the door this morning, you know, I walked in the door and saw this new bright face that had volunteered to be Shika. And in that, this person is not just going to be greeting people, but watching what arises for me when I do that. And the other thing is taking on activities. So for many of you who've been around for a while, most of my suffering and my awakening from suffering has come in the kitchen, you know, kitchen practice, right? So much kitchen practice. And I've also been blessed with the opportunity at this point in my Zen career, you could say, to have the opportunity to begin to meet with people in practice discussion, and also meeting people in my clinical practice, which I don't see as any different in terms of a practice for me. And so I'm very grateful at this point to be able to have that opportunity and that inspiration to deepen my own practice and my own wisdom because I have the privilege of meeting others. I was just in Tasahara for 4 or 5 days. I was doing the Zen part of a Tai Chi and Zen workshop. Tasahara is the monastery, this magical monastery. You have to travel an hour down a dirt road where you inevitably want to puke at least one or two points in the road. At least I do. And it doesn't sound so romantic, but once you arrive, it's pretty romantic. And when I was there, I always want to meet with one of the most important teachers to me, a woman by the name of Leslie James. Ah, I love her. And to me, she epitomizes what the practice of Zen is all about. She has quietly and competently been running Tasahara for 30 years, just the heartbeat. You never see her out front, hardly see her out front. She's imperturbable. She's witnessed every drama under the sun there. and yet she just kind of goes about her business. So she and I were talking, and we both kind of agreed that we would much rather be spending a day doing laundry or washing dishes than studying and preparing for a talk. So comforting. And you know, that's a good thing, because in Zen, we don't privilege one kind of activity over another. We don't believe, you know, that the wisdom and compassion arises just when you're doing this or when you're doing this. That it arises, it's the potentiality of it, and the expression of it arises, you know, when you're folding those little hand towels for everybody to use. So this is what I love about Zen. You know, how would a Buddha wash a dish? You know, how would a Buddha greet somebody who's coming into the door for the first time? This is what we do. So this emphasis is on a deep, caring engagement with what's happening moment to moment, with the dish, with what's happening inside of us, and also with whoever we happen to meet. And through that, we can deeply, and in the moment, you know, this is, in our way, we say enlightenment is right here. Practice and enlightenment is right here, right now. It's not this kind of lofty goal that you get to kind of transcend and rise up to the heavens, you know, and never be affected by the yuckiness of our day-to-day world. So this morning, I wanted to see if I can find some way, in a very practical way, a descriptive way, to talk about how the practice helps us to develop this trust that allows us to live more with presence and openness. You know, with this vow, you know, what would it look like for a world where everybody is welcomed for who they are and who they love? So another way of saying this is, how can we open to our experience, moment-to-moment experience, without being threatened by it? So many of you know, and this is, you know, this talk is geared for beginners, and we're all beginners, so I just want to start with the fundamental assumption again of Buddhism, which is that suffering, the way we suffer, our anxiety, our fears, are created and maintained by a sense of what we call a permanent separate sense of self, or a sense of separation. And we believe it to be permanent, and we do it, we do this in a way because we feel, the separate self feels it has to protect itself from threats, from what it perceives as the outside world. Ajushanti had this great way of putting it. He says, you know, it's the grasping, we grasp the self. So he says, grasping is not something that is done by the self. The self is something done by grasping. So grasping is what creates that sense of self. You know what, Ian, I need a clock. How did you know? See what happens after years of practicing together. So I want to start at the beginning, kind of build up, if you would bear with me for a moment. Thank you. And I have to stop when? I should. Okay. So what I'm a psychotherapist, clinical social worker, I'm proud to say. So I wanted to start with what I understand to be part of the development of a constricted self through a psychological lens for a moment. So, and this makes sense from the position of Zen as well. So in order to have a self that can be open to experience without closing, without defense, we need to have a felt sense of trust in our own bodies that we can navigate our environment without closing down. So very basic, right? And by environment, I'm talking about both people as well as, you know, the setting. So in order for us to have that felt sense of trust that we can navigate our environment without closing down, with openness, we would have had to have enough relational experiences, particularly early in life, of being responded to with sensitivity and care from the environment. So that makes sense, right? So, you know, when we're young, when we're infants, we are actually extremely vulnerable to threats. I think human beings are the most vulnerable mammals. They have the least, like, functionality of any infant. So we actually really, in a very basic survival way, we need to have a felt sense of others who we can trust and we can protect us from threat and also help us to form a safe, positive connection. Now, the important thing is, as any other therapist knows in the room, it doesn't have to be perfect. What a burden. How impossible. It just has to be trustworthy enough. It has to be reliable enough that our bodies can begin to relax and we can begin to open. And this need for a positive, safe connection is so primal, we literally can't survive without it. And we think, okay, we can't survive it without it as a child, but actually that need for positive connection to other beings, to our environment, continues throughout our whole life. There's this many studies about this, but one study that kind of captures this is there was a study that surviving spouses have, I think, like a 66% chance of dying within the first 3 months of their partner's death. So, you know, this is not something we get over, our need for others. And then to bring it back to our practice, in order to trust this body of teaching that says we are interconnectedness, this is the primary teaching, we are interconnectedness, we are not separate, we are a manifestation of everything and everybody else, we are only in connection, it's impossible not to be, but in order to trust that in our bodies, we need to trust or learn to trust connection. Sounds, everybody with me so far? Yeah. Yet, throughout human history, this lack of trust in ourselves and in our environment and in life has been, you could say, more the norm than the exception. You know, that this lack of trust creates the conditions for violence, for harm. And unfortunately, this threat and from the outside that shakes our a sense of trust does not just come from a societal other, you know, not just from a policeman in the street or, you know, a storm coming. It comes from sometimes those closest to us. So as we develop this sense of separation, you know, that we begin to feel is made more rigid when, you know, it kind of gets rigid in response to threats to our positive connection, especially to those we care about. And when others feel unsafe, when they feel misattuned, when they feel violent or annihilating to us, or potentially annihilating to us, we learn, what do we learn to do? We learn to push away. So we avert, as the Buddha would say, we start aversion. We push away. We push the other away. And that push might mean anger. It might mean a literal push. I'm going to push you away, Koshin. I don't like the way you're looking at me right now. Or it might just be a kind of tightening of our bodies or a closing off of our hearts and minds. And we all do this. We all do it kind of in an instant, in a flash. It can happen. No, so we don't just push when we feel threatened, we also grasp. So we push and we grasp. So what do we grasp? We try to manipulate our environment and control things so we can return to this sense of comfort and safety and belonging, you know? I'm gonna make everything perfect in the Zen Center. Everyone's gonna be quiet. The cushions are all gonna be just where I want them to be and I'm gonna be able to relax, you know? Good luck, right, Eno? these kinds of activities are really what the Buddha is talking about. You know, we can't control and manipulate. You know, that creates disease, dissatisfaction, anxiety. So all of that closing is that dukkha that the Buddha is talking about. And to me, this is, you could say, the most unfortunate part or the saddest part of this story of self. We don't just push others away. So our mind and our heart, and I say mind-heart together because this is how it is in Zen. Mind is actually mind-heart. And it helps to kind of remind us that we are a full being, you know. So our mind-heart often responds to threats with self-aggression. We also turn aggressively towards ourselves. So what we do, what do? We push away something within ourselves that we feel is the cause of the separation, of the exile, you know. Oh my God, you know, if I get angry, this person is out of town. I'm going to lose my partner if I scream at him. Luckily, that hasn't happened so far yet. No, I am never going to get angry. I am going to shove that anger down. So we start to separate in our own minds and bodies. We hide parts that we feel might create exile. And then we're pushing away, and we're also grasping. What are we grasping? We're grasping ideas of ourselves that will make us all safe and lovable and never risk exile, you know? If I just come up with the most brilliant talk this afternoon, I don't ever have to worry about being judged or being dismissed, you know? I'll be safe. So what happens is we lose trust in our wholeness, and then we divide. And this is the creation of the duality. And when you don't see wholeness in everything, in ourselves and other people, that is the root of our violence. So the Buddha really, like all of his teachings, are geared toward how to undo this dilemma. You know, how do we begin to unite what's been divided in ourselves, and also, and this is, you know, the really important kind of point I want to make today, which is we don't just do it internally with ourselves. We create a community that also embodies the possibility of harmonious connection, you know, that is safe enough, trustworthy enough. And we all create that community together by our own practice. So perhaps this feeling I have is one that people have felt throughout history, but I do feel like there's a heightened awareness right now of the pain of this violent legacy of separation. And the threat of it feels more urgent than ever. So this is not just like something we do for ourselves as a bodhisattva. We do this exploration about healing and wholeness in order to help heal the thing that threatens so many beings, so many animals, so many plants, you know, the earth itself, herself. Okay, so how do we do this? How do we develop a sense of trust in ourselves and each other? How can we open to our experience with fluidity and a kind of freedom, even when we're in the midst of a threat, what some are calling revolutionary love? You know, in this Tai Chi workshop I just did, the amazing Tai Chi master, Sally, she showed this, she had me put a fist out, right? I put a fist out. I can kind of not do it to myself. Dexter, would you do it with me for a second? So just give me a good fist. Okay, so she said, you know, if I meet that fist with a fist, right, there's just stuckness, right? There's just no movement. And if I meet that fist by collapsing, right, there's no engagement. We're not transforming, right? So she talked about how do you meet that energy? You get close to it. You don't get far away from it. You go close in. You don't meet it head on in an aggressive way. You kind of like brush it, like you kind of like peel it off, right? You stay in contact. You get kind of intimate with it, and you learn how to be with it, yeah? And so we're still engaged. Maybe his energy is loosening up a little bit, right? But we're in contact. So that's the, how do we do that as beings, right? Thank you, Dexter. So in Zen, as I said, we do this by studying our body, studying our feelings, studying our thoughts, taking responsibility for them in the moment of that arising of threat. But we also, or not threat, but we also developed all of these wonderful forms to help us learn how to do that, to kind of feel that. So I'm kind of fascinated by the dance and the reflection of each other of psychological wisdom and Buddhist wisdom, which I think many of us in the West are excited about. And so as a way to kind of frame this development of trust, I wanted to mention this theory of mind that was developed by this Hungarian-born British psychoanalyst called Peter Fonagy. And he talked about mental models that we create. And these we create in childhood, and they're a way of making sense of our own and others' behavior. So we start to develop these mental like states of or mental models. It's like a programming on how we navigate self and others. So he saw that Fonagy saw that based on our attachment experience, meaning, you know, was others felt as safe or threatening, you know? Was there a painful, mostly, or a not so painful connection? That's how we develop these mental models, and we develop either a lesser or greater capacity to reflect on our experience accurately, especially when the experience is emotionally charged. So if we have trauma experiences, what happens is we lose our capacity basically to stay in reality. And I mean this literally, right? You know, we just kind of lose contact with ourselves. So he called, there's three kinds of mental experiences, and I want to take a moment to spell them out because I think they might be helpful in terms of watching the mind. So, and these are supposed to be developmentally sequentially. He may not mean to use them in the way I'm going to use them, but I do think that we can kind of regress back into them in a way. So the first is called the psychic equivalence mode. It's not very poetic. Like, what? So this is, there's like in a psychic equivalence mode, when we're in this kind of mental state, we kind of lose contact with our interiority. So what happens is there's no difference between beliefs and facts. Exterior equals interior. So I'll give you an example. We're kind of like moved around by what's happening on the outside world. We're overly moved around by what's going on. So, for example, when we're treated badly by somebody, we say to ourselves, I am bad. We feel bad. We take that on without any kind of digestion. And then, now I am bad. We are bad. And the feeling we are bad says, we know we will be treated badly. So it's all like, it's all external. The second is what he calls pretend mode, and you can imagine why this developed, you know? So in the pretend mode, the internal and external are not in full communication. There's kind of a retreat to the internal. So we ignore the external and make up an internal story that feels more real to us than the information coming from our senses. So your brain literally rejects information that doesn't confirm who you think you are, who you want to be. We can, you know, we have kind of living examples in our political system right now of this, you know. And you can even see this, I think, around climate change, you know. It's like an unwillingness to pay attention to the information coming in that threatens your internal sense of things. And so in this state, we're more likely to deny or disassociate. So the third mode is called the reflective mode. And in this mode, there's more of a fluidity and a capacity to have an internal world and have an external world, and they can kind of be in dialogue with each other and influence each other. And this gives us a better capacity to accurately interpret reality. And you can kind of know when you're in that mode, right? Like when people are in that mode, like you can have a dialogue with them. You know, they're able to take you in and also not just forget themselves. So this reflective capacity, the reason I'm mentioning it is essential for our ability to develop empathy and to develop wisdom. And so basically when we enter practice, we actually have to have a reflective capacity. You know, I don't think any of you would come into this room if you didn't have some ability to have reflected that something is, you know, maybe causing me suffering, or there's some way that I want to see how I might change or transform in order to be more in alignment maybe with my values. So Zen, you could say, is a primary vehicle for enhancing this reflective functioning capacity. So many of us in the room, if you're here for any period of time, we hope that you take the precepts study and practice looking at our ethical ways. How do we, you know, when do we hold on to anger? How do we create harm in the specificity of our lives? And so that's one way in which we can begin to kind of deepen this reflective capacity. Or when taking on the role of Eno, I'll use the Eno as an example. You know, what happens in our minds when we interact with others from an authority position, right? Okay, I got to tell people what to do now. And so what's my mental characterization of authority? So we start to recognize, oh my God, you know, to be an authority is to be an asshole. You know, excuse me, as you're saying, for cursing. But I am in Brooklyn, so I think it's okay. I was just in California and I felt I couldn't do that. And so what we do is we begin to notice that, and we begin to notice when we project that onto others. You know, this, it's like, we'd be like, oh, you know what? Kristen looked at me that way. She, you know, she thinks, you know, she doesn't want to take my authority, you know? And then we reflect that back to ourselves, you know? So we start to notice how we do that. This is how we create separation. This is how we start to feel threat. So for most of us, as we begin to deepen our awareness and study our mind in community, we begin to notice how we hit blocks in our ability to stay reflective. So what happens is the pain of our current experience causes us to close. This is like a threat has happened. We're closing up the channel between me and the world. I'm going to go back into one of these other modes. So we might make a mistake ringing the bell, or we act unskillfully with somebody and hurt somebody in the Sangha. So what we might do is regress to the first mental mode through a feeling of shame. I did something bad, therefore I am bad. We're gone. You know, that reflection of the complexity of that dependent co-arising is gone. I am just bad. You know, when we're confronted with the reality of how our embodiment of whiteness results in privilege, we may revert to the second mode, denying our privilege because it threatens that internal sense of who we are. I don't want to look at that. Goodbye. Or we might just, you know, cut off our reality through the physical act. You know, I'm going to hold my breath. I'm holding my breath because I want to keep out the reality of this flood of feelings, of maybe humiliation, of shame, of maybe even like connectedness that feels too much for me. So all of our practices here are designed to build this capacity to stay open and reflected even in those moments of challenge, you know, to start to be settled in our unsettledness. You know, so if someone comes to me in practice discussion and says, oh my God, you know, it was like lovely, I could relax here, and now, oh, yeah, I feel like, you know, this person is angry at me and I don't know what to do, you know? Yay, right? Well, now you're practicing, this is good. So how do we do that? It's very overwhelming, you know? And again, some of us have trauma histories, myself included, where like it feels like all I can do is hang on to staying present. So what we do is we kind of take refuge in the structural integrity of our practice. And that's a bodily thing. You know, we take refuge in, we are like, okay, I'm being flooded, you know, let me go into Zazen posture. Let me get that spine back up. You know, let me start breathing. Let me remember what it feels like to bow or to take care of something. You know, I can barely move, but I'm going to like water my plant with tremendous devotion. And all of these things support a mind being able to eventually feel safe and stable and trusting again. And these embodied practices are not just arbitrary. They kind of are infused, you can say, with attitudes of uprightness, of devotion. You know, we literally say, you know, don't kick your cushion. That is an object to be cared for with devotion. Nothing is to be treated recklessly. You know, equanimity, we ask people to be wholehearted, you know, victory. If you make a mistake with the bell, make it all the way, you know, go. That's great, you know, wholeheartedly, don't hold back. So the practices are all a way of feeling and remembering in our bodies what compassion and interconnectedness and wisdom feels like. You know, so what happens is we start to develop what Paul Haller at San Francisco Zen Center calls a dharmic disposition in our bodies and mind as opposed to a karmic disposition. And this is through repetitive motion, repetitive practicing. And the other thing I really want to emphasize, I get so excited, I have to slow down. I feel so passionate about our practice, it's great. And I think it's because I have, again, been in the privilege of teaching the precept class, or really not teaching, but just guiding others around this study. So this precept study, this moral commitment, that's what creates a safe relational field for each other so we can develop trust. That's what rebuilds that sense of trust so our bodies can relax. If it wasn't for the precepts, we could not have a healthy sangha. We could not open up and ask to open up and let go of things that we felt we needed to hold on to. We couldn't drop away body and mind if we didn't feel the environment was safe. And the precepts are huge around that. And it's not because, as anyone knows, we do these precepts perfectly. We do them good enough. And what we do is, which is so healthy for us as beings with each other, we take complete responsibility as much as we can for what we are bringing to a situation. Okay, let me let you know, even though I'm telling you you're a jerk, I'm gonna own kind of, you know, what's going on with me. And then we can kind of have reality mirrored a little bit more clearly to each other, which makes us feel safe. It just has to be good enough, you know? And then if we do something, you know, if I'm a jerk to Katie, you know, I apologize and I confess, and I offer myself and her compassion, you know, over and over and over and over again. And we watch and see how other people do it. So we walk into an environment, we see people treating us this way, and we go, oh, maybe this place is pretty safe, you know? So we practice this way, we practice with each other and with ourselves over and over, and our bodies and minds and hearts begin to relax and open. Now that doesn't mean like it's like sequential. Okay, I've been here 4 years, now my body and heart are this relaxed and open all the time. No, you know, 2 minutes, I'm like, oh, I'm getting pretty good with the talk. I'm not terrified, you know. I walk in, I see all of you, you know. It happens right in a moment like that. But what does happen is that there's kind of more capacity, right? So I can like be here, and I'm actually really here, you know. There isn't a lot of like, get out of here, Laura, right now, you know. There's not a lot of judgment, you know, that I'm projecting onto you guys. Maybe you have it, maybe you don't. And this is what transforms our mental models. And I want to just say this because this was what I realized was so important for me is I used to really be terrified here. And what I came to realize is the reason I was is because of judgment, because of my own mental model of judgment. And I don't mean judgment like, oh, you did good or didn't good. I mean like condemnation, you know, that kind of judgment. And what I realized, it does not matter if I'm judging you or I'm judging myself. It does not matter. Judgment, condemning judgment creates anxiety and disease and fear. And so, and then what we do is not only we have it, we have it here, we project it, you know? Like, after this talk, I have to work with the possibility that I might take all of you and create a judge, you know? But I have made a vow, I am not going to do that anymore, because that creates such suffering and sense of separation and fear in my body, and I just won't have it, you know? It's not fair to you guys either. You know, you can judge me if you want, but I'm not gonna take it on. So just to end, I'd like to offer in a playful way a fourth mental model that isn't found in the attachment literature, but in our champ books. The founder of Soto Zen in Japan, Eihei Dogen, who is, you know, our favorite Zen master, I could say, in Zen, describes what could be called this fourth mental model that goes beyond the psychologically receptive mode, reflective mode that we're talking about. What he calls it is self-receiving and self-fulfilling samadhi. So in this mental mode, which is a little more challenging to describe, but you know, I think we all have the experience of this. I just want to say this is not some exotic, foreign thing that, you know, some lucky people who've sat for 45 years get to feel. We all have felt this, particularly if we sit long sesshins or just by an act of grace as we're walking in the woods. The mental mode of this self-fulfilling and self-receiving samadhi is that there's the boundary between inside and outside, between external and internal, between self and other, kind of dissolve, like drops away. And we're in this more receptive and direct experiencing of what's happening right now without a lot of stuff going on, a lot of constructs. So even the reflective mode might have a little bit more analysis to it, but this kind of all drops away. It's also responsive. It's not like when body and mind drop away, you kind of like are frozen in some zone and you're gone. You're here. It's just that when we're here, we allow the experience to come to us, to tell us what it needs, as opposed to us imposing our understanding on the experience. So you still have a discerning capacity. It's not like your mind is gone. It's just that it's still and it's clear and it's responsive and not so self-oriented, you know? So what I'd like to do to end is just give three or four quotes about how Dogen talks about this. And again, the intellectual mind, it might be a little bit challenging, but if what I invite you to do is, you know, and if you want to close your eyes, just see if you can just allow this understanding to drop into your body and feel it. So here are the quotes of this mental mode or model. Immediacy is dropping away with no obstacles. Realization, neither general nor particular, is effort without desire. clear water all the way to the bottom. A fish swims like a fish. Vast sky transparent throughout. A bird flies like a bird. This is when Suzuki Roshi says, you know, when you are you, Zen is Zen. Here's another. In the quietness of Zazen, our separate thoughts and perceptions of the world at one moment disappear into the wholeness, which is the direct experience of reality, and at one moment appear together again from the wholeness. This one many of you might know. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. When you let go, the Dharma fills your hands. It is not within the boundary of one or many. And this is the last one. As your mind and surroundings sit together in stillness, awakening flows in, affirmation flows out. So this affirmation is this deep trust of life itself. So, you know, in our practice, we just learn to care for and respect everything as a reflection of life, as a network of relationships, as a fluid dance between inside and outside. And I love this quote by Stephen Batchelor. He writes a book about emptiness and what emptiness is. And he says, you know, contrary to expectation, an empty self is a relational self. So our practice is a way to learn to be with what arises in our field with an open and responsive heart mind. Suzuki Roshi calls it a soft, pliable mind, or a beginner's mind. And please, you know, we don't grasp this. You know, as soon as we grasp it, it's gone. You know, we're far away, hair's breadth deviation between heaven and earth. So we just sit, you know, so our practice is sincerely, wholeheartedly, with care, with kindness, with as much trust as we can feel in ourselves and each other, we open to what's happening in the moment. And then we especially open up to the places within ourselves that want to contract in the face of threat. So in a way, you could say we are, you know, bodhisattvas in training for this revolutionary love. How do we open up in the middle of that, those kinds of threats, you know? And as a person, based on my privilege and my position in society, I have never had to face a literal fist in my face. I have no idea what the capacity of my practice is to meet that with skillfulness. So I'm not saying this is easy, and I'm not saying this from the position that it's, you know, I've got it all figured out, or we have it figured out. This is, but you know, what else are we gonna do if we don't wanna meet violence with violence? We have to kind of train, you know? So this is our training ground together. You know, and we create it too. So, 10 of, how did I do? Yeah? Sure, thank you very much. I'd love to. Hi.
So about a year ago, asking a question in a moment like this, I would judge myself for it afterwards. How did I ask the question? Did I say exactly what I wanted to say, etc.?
Yes.
So asking a question is different than giving a Dharma talk. So I'm curious.
Kinda. Not so much.
I'm curious how the shift happened for you when you, in the past, after giving a talk, would have this judgment, and then you now are, you won't have that anymore. Because if I go away, or one of us asks a question, question goes away and stuff comes up, and we're like, I don't have that. It could be a pushing away of stuff that actually needs to be felt.
Yes, absolutely.
So how is that shift? How was that shift for you? What is that?
Well, I think this is an ongoing practice for me. So I'll confess. You know, I was just at Tassajara. I was, you know, this is a place I trained at. This is where the place where, like, the big Zen people are at, you know? And it's like a kind of a change in my orientation, but I'm just a student here. I've been, you know, I remember 20 years ago, terrified. And I'm teaching, you know? So that part of me, that small self, was still there. I didn't realize it, you know? And the first day, it was a lovely little retreat, but, you know, I said some things, and I asked for questions, and everyone just stared at me for like 10 minutes. You know, felt like it was probably a minute and a half. And it happened. I walked out of that place, and I just felt like shit, you know? And boom, this threat happened. You know, I lost that reflective capacity. I kind of felt shame, you know? But luckily I was in Tassajara, luckily I've been practicing for God knows how long, and I sat and I remembered, I need to open up to that place in me, I need to reassure it, I need to say I'm with you, I need to like just feel it and hold it with love. And it may take hours, it might take days to calm down, it took me a little while. And then it's so funny, you know, because the next day, you know, somebody gave a Dharma talk, and they looked really vulnerable and sweet and a little scared. And I was like, oh, I love you, you know. So then I felt better, you know. I felt like more, okay, he's being himself. I was just being myself. You know, I remembered. The reflective capacity came back online. And then not only that, because of that, I actually could, kind of fall into samadhi, because, you know, that dropped away through my loving care of it, and I actually felt deeper and more present and more connected to Tassajara than I would have if I didn't go through that. So we welcome it, you know? Yeah, but thank you. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, you're the person I'm most practice conflict with. Our life and our relationship is not our own. Okay, what happens is Greg and I meet each other like this. I'll even take responsibility. I meet Greg with this, right? And here we are, and my first impulse is to fight, you know? You are wrong. Wrong, 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 you know, and then Greg might meet me like, I am not wrong. And then, you know, a little time goes by, and then, you know what happens for me? Sometimes what happened is collapse. Oh, I am so bad. I'm so sorry, Greg. I'm terrible, and you're wonderful, and I should, you know, never have gotten angry with you. Collapse. What is he going to do with that? You know, that's like, I'm not there. I'm not taking responsibility. So then, like, okay. Then I come back and I say, you know what? When you said this, like, I got scared. Or I just miss you. And I'm upset you're going back to Zen Center again. You know, whatever. I stay really close, you know? I stay really close to what's going on for me. I try to open up, okay, now Greg's going to tell me, you know, when you do this, kind of I lose, you know, I feel like, you know, inhibited in some way, right? Oh, close, we're staying close, we're listening, we're kind of softening that up, we're in contact, yeah. Does that make sense? How you do that in other realms, you know? Okay, I'll give you one quick example. I'm on the subway. This man is sitting in the corner. I get on the subway. I walk in. I look at him and I say, "Hi," you know. And he looks at me, and I think it's because, again, the embodiments we both hold. You know, I don't know. I don't know. That's part of it. I don't know. That's a big part of this. He says to me, "Don't you look at me?" why didn't you smile at him? Smile at him, don't smile at me, really angry, you know? I was like, I start to feel the shame arise, and then I'm just like, okay, let me stay with this. And I stayed with it, and I actually felt into the pain of what I imagined, again, just my imagination of my whole history of being, you know, a white woman, his whole history, person of color, I don't know, because that other guy was white, I'm just making this all up, I don't know. You know, but it gave me an opportunity to practice, like, how do I open up to the history that might be part of the reason that is happening? And I could defend myself, or I could be like, no, no, I'm okay, you know, I'm just a nice white girl, you know. I didn't mean any harm. He woke me up, he was teaching me something. Why didn't I? You know, what was going on? I don't know, you know. But I also didn't just take his position, you know what? I had this feeling in my body of like, you know what? I still want to smile at you. I don't smile at him anymore because he doesn't want that, you know. But I can keep the smile inside. I'm like, I'm still open, you know. You haven't closed me down, which I'm grateful for, but you taught me something. Yeah. Does it make sense?
It does.
Okay. He said it on the way out again. And I can't remember if I said it out loud or just to myself. It's like, I don't care, I'm staying open. You know, like that's kind of how I felt inside. But then I got off the train. So, yeah.
Question, and I think this came up just when you mentioned that you're a therapist. When I'm new to practice, but I've been in therapy, and one of the things that I guess I'm not sure of is when difficult emotions or thoughts come up, you know, while sitting. I guess I'm used to from therapy being sort of active in responding to those thoughts and emotions.
Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What does it mean to be active? Just give me an example.
It might be saying to myself, I understand why that's coming up now. You know, it reminds you of this. You're not 14 anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So a sort of self-talk, and it's even if it's sort of compassionate and not harsh, it's still active.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm sitting, I get the feeling that I shouldn't be doing that sort of active kind of work. That it should be much more receptive. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? I mean, is that the way people sit and the way they respond to emotions and thoughts,
yeah,
as they come up?
It's a great question, and I would say there is no one correct. You know, it's what we would say skillful means. What's a skillful means? And I would suggest, you know, sometimes we actually really need to give out a big self-talk because we're about to collapse, you know, so pull out all the guns of what you would say to yourself. But I think mostly we can do it in a little bit of, and I think we trust almost in our own body's ability to kind of be compassion with that over time, which is quieter and maybe even more visceral. So it's kind of like the imagery I use is just like, okay, there's a 14-year-old who's hurting, you know, and I'm just going to be really close to them with an open heart. And that doesn't even really need words, you know. So it's, in a way, you're having your dual awareness. You're cultivating that one who can be with, as well as opening up to that, you know, because some people just dismiss that. Oh, no, I need to, like, do Zazen now. Go away, 14-year-old, you know. Or we just get collapsed in, like, the 14-year-old's view of the world. So it's really this intimacy. And you can play with that, you know. But I actually think that these things inevitably come up because there's a safe environment. It's like, I'm quiet, I'm listening. The 14-year-old's like, oh, you're listening to me right now, you know. Let me tell you about my pain, right? And again, this is not words, right? It just comes up as a feeling of, you know, I don't know, awkwardness. And then you kind of like, just with your awareness, like meet that with kind of just a quiet yes, you know? And then see if it quiets down. Or you might even be like, okay, yes, let's just breathe together. Then we return together to breathing, You know, and then eventually that self and other, internal self and other kind of drop away, and you're just kind of one being kind of breathing together. So you might play with that a little bit, just returning to your breath as the support, or your body as a support. Thank you all very much. May our intentions equally penetrate.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by the Brooklyn Zen Center. Our programs are given free of charge and made possible by the donations we receive. For more information on supporting Brooklyn Zen Center, please visit the giving section of brooklynzen.org.